have an AA meeting. My name is Megan, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with at least 1 year of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal story is described in their own language and form their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and our clear idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later at aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of this shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight is Elizabeth R.
Hey everybody, I'm Elizabeth and I am an alcoholic. Yes. Grateful to be here and to be sober. That's what I'm supposed to say right now. I am. Thank you for asking me to do this. Wow, there's a lot of you in here. Okay. My sobriety date is June 10th, 1993, so Lisa and I are cohorts. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, et cetera, et cetera, home group, all that good stuff. Clarkson 12-step is my home group, has been since my second meeting. Some people say, well, God, how did you get to almost 30 years? And I'm like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think I did some things that were suggested to me, certainly not all of them. Defiance can still be a characteristic from time to time. And I believe, and I say this relatively often in meetings, that this program works me in spite of myself if I suit up and show up and will and take some suggestions. And that's definitely been my experience. As an old sponsor of mine used to say, that experience of God right in a straight line with a crooked pen. I am a Yankee, in case you can't tell from my lack of a southern accent. I came to Atlanta in 1979, and I stayed, so that's a different kind of expression, but I won't say that. I was born in Connecticut to an alcoholic family. I was a surprise 10 years after my two older sisters, and so, you know, early years, I don't remember a whole lot of chaos. I do remember that I never really saw my dad much because he worked in Manhattan and we lived in Connecticut, so he commuted, and he loved that bar car. That much I can tell you. Was a real point of contention between he and my mom a lot. We moved to Manhattan when I was 7, I think. I don't remember, obviously. I was 7. I do remember there was a lot of fighting. That I do remember. I also remember that my mother had a potential suicide attempt when I was about 6. And don't ask me why I remember this, but I remember that I don't think the elementary school knew why my mother was in the hospital, but because everybody, all my classmates wrote get well cards to my mother, because I think they thought she was sick, which she was, obviously, with alcoholism and wanting to commit suicide, if that was the goal. So, one of the things I'm most amazed with this program is that what happens in our lives, and this is my experience anyway, what happened in my life before I got here, and a lot of the stuff that happened to me in childhood, which was not the greatest stuff, this program has given me the ability to look at that differently and to see that differently. And the circumstances haven't changed, but I've been able to look at those things and see them differently, see the people involved differently. And I'm very grateful for that. It's not something, excuse me. Anyway, I didn't see my dad much in the beginning years of my life because he was gone. He was taking the train to Manhattan, coming back, and he was, you know, get home late, left early, so on and so forth. I did see him on the weekends, and I have to say that he made an effort to have a relationship with me even though we didn't have much time together. Every Sunday, he would get up and take me down to the local coffee shop in Westport and drink coffee and read the paper with his cronies and have me at the little counter reading my little comics and drinking my little hot chocolate. And that was like my favorite thing in the world. It was just like I lived for that every weekend because I didn't get to see him very much. And then the Sunday came when he was, I think, particularly hungover. And I'd gotten up really early because I was super excited and had all my Barbie houses and all my Barbie dolls and all my stuff out. And he came downstairs and he was like, clean this up or you're not going with me. And I was like, what? And he meant it. And I didn't care. I think I was 5-ish, maybe 6. He left. I put on my coat and I started walking down the road like I knew where I was going. Little alcoholic kind of personality twist there, probably. Don't tell me what to do. Luckily, a family that lived close by picked me up and brought me home. And in retrospect, because my sisters were so much older than I am, what I thought was true about a lot of things as I was growing up was not necessarily what was really the truth. And I found those things out much later. I think my sisters tried to protect me from a lot of the dysfunction and the alcoholism in the house as best they could. That's been an interesting journey to learn things like that my mother actually was an alcoholic about 10 years ago. We moved to Manhattan. This is one of those things. I thought that we moved to Manhattan because my mother didn't like my dad commuting. I was probably in my 30s, maybe, when my sister said, no, it's because we lost the house. Dad was drinking so much that the, you know, checks were bouncing. And mortgage company finally said, gotta go. So we moved to Manhattan, and life went on. Drinking got worse for both of them. When I was, I will say, you know, we talk in the literature about feeling different or not fitting in or, you know, not connecting, whatever, whatever. And I never really thought about that. I mean, even though I've been sober for a while, it took a long time for that one to sink in. And when it sank in was when I was telling my story one time. And I remembered that there's not a lot of people, probably not a lot of people in this room that are my age, but my favorite book when I was a kid was called Harriet the Spy. And Harriet the Spy used to like to wear a raincoat and dark glasses and a hat, and she used to carry around a little notebook and a pad and a pen, and she would like write notes about everybody all the time. Wherever she went, she was writing notes. So I think back about that, and I was like, oh, I was taking people's inventory when I was like 10. Right? And I thought it was so cool, you know. But, you know, I think some of that for me was I didn't want to look at what was happening in our home. And I didn't want to look at the fact that I didn't feel like I fit in. I wasn't into sports. I wasn't a jock. I wasn't particularly scholastically, you know, dynamic. I didn't have, like, a niche, really. Probably, if there was anything, it was music, acting kind of thing. You know, in spite of my dad's drinking, we had a good, pretty good life. We didn't really go without. And I think, like I said, a lot of the things that happened were hidden from me. When I was 13, actually when I was 9, my mom and I were out shopping, and she had a stroke when we were together, just the two of us. And I didn't know what was going on. I was 9, right? And she was trying to call a taxi, and she was like, Maxie. And I thought she was joking. I didn't know. And we got in the taxi, and she was like, tell the driver. She had the foresight to say, tell the driver, I'm very sick and I need to get home right away. And I was like, okay. And so we did, and we got home. And for the next 4 years, I guess, ambulance at our house was kind of a regular thing. She should probably not have been drinking alcoholically, given that she had severe hypertension, arteriosclerosis. But, you know, alcoholism knows no bounds, man. I'm not going to stop just because, you know, I should stop for my health, you know. Why would I do that? So when I was 13, she had a stroke that killed her. And, you know, I always say that my life took kind of a hard right, left, I'm not sure which way, some term, pretty hard. And then a month later, because my dad, bless his heart, and my dad had gotten sober a year before she died. He got sober when I was 12. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a big resentment against Alcoholics Anonymous, not knowing much about Alcoholics Anonymous except for the fact that, you know, my dad wasn't drinking anymore. He was sober, whatever that meant, I didn't understand. But he was gone just as much. And that made me mad. And it made my mom mad. My sisters were already up and out of the house, and it was just me and my mom and my dad. But, you know, I kind of thought that when my mom was gone, my dad and I would get close and support each other and so on and so forth. But my dad, and I learned a lot about him later in life about his childhood, and I'm a firm believer that you know, childhood things affect us. Now, I'm not saying it made me an alcoholic, but he had some pretty rough stuff to deal with as a child. Really, really rough. And I don't think there's a manual about how to raise children. Is there, Liz? I don't think there is. I just came to learn a lot about him, and it changed my perception of him. But I came to hate Alcoholics Anonymous because he was gone all the time. That was my perception at the time. And I didn't see a whole lot of change in behavior, I guess. But anyway, one of the things that my dad, that was true about my dad, is he didn't do well being alone. And that was clearly as a result of his childhood. So he remarried a month and a half after my mother died. And, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with this laundry list of all the things that had happened to me and all the ways that I'd been treated poorly, you know, my mother dying young, that happening with my dad. It was all, you know, all that stuff was the reason I drank, right? That's what I thought. And I'm sure some of it was. I'm sure I drank over some of it. Those things are not what defined me anymore. They were what defined me when I got here, and they're not anymore. And they haven't been for a long time, and I'm grateful for that. But he remarried to a woman that couldn't have been more opposite from my mother, bless her heart. She was a good person, but she'd never had children. She didn't know what to do with me. I was angry and defiant and, you know, sneaking out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were... Anyway, they decided the cure would be to ship me off to boarding school halfway across the country. And, you know, I say this because I believe it's true. That school and the education I got there held me in good stead for all these years, really. What little I partook of it is the truth, because I wasn't really interested in getting education except for in life and drinking and doing other things. And so I was there for 3 years, and I'm really grateful for that, because those people became my family. I didn't know any of them, but those kids who had families that lived in Richmond took me in, and I spent some holidays with those people. And so, you know, I think the ability to look back on things and see them differently is a huge gift of this program. And so, anyway, by some miracle of God, I graduated from high school, not from that school, another school. You know, got a job doing something. I had no interest in going to college. And I had no aim in life. I had no goal. I had no direction. I had no interest, really, in anything except for drinking and partying and having as little responsibility as possible. So I found waitressing, and that was awesome, because you could drink on the job there too, at least for me. And so I was like, man, I'm home now. I don't have to do anything else for the rest of my life. Well, you know, 65, 75-year-old cocktail waitresses are probably not, you know, around often. But not that that's how old I am. I'm not saying that. But I'm not a person who had, I guess, what people would call a supremely low bottom. I didn't go to jail all the time. I didn't get a DUI, which is a miracle. That is, if that isn't God working in my life, I don't know what is, because I drove from Buckhead to Decatur 4 to 7 nights a week in a total blackout and never got a DUI. And the only reason I could, I don't even know why, other than that I'm supposed to be here sharing the message wherever I can. I don't know. I don't know why me and why not other people. Because I could have killed a lot of people. I could have killed myself. I could have been in jail many times. But for whatever reason, that's not part of my story. I did go to jail one time, and it was as a result of my drinking, but it wasn't because I had been drinking. You know, the rules didn't apply to me in any area of life. So, and especially being a New Yorker, I had that arrogance, whatever. And, you know, growing up in New York, my sisters, my family would get traffic tickets, they'd throw them in the trash. So that's what I did. I was hell on wheels. I didn't learn how to drive until I was 21, so I had to make up for a lot of lost time. And so I would get a ticket for a moving violation, and I just throw it in the trash. Well, you know what? Anybody in the room know what happens when you throw a lot of those in the trash? There's a bench warrant out for your arrest, right? Bench warrant. So I'm driving to my cocktail waitressing job one night at Confetti on Roswell Road in Buckhead, dressed kind of like a hooker because we had to wear costumes, and that was kind of like what my costume was for the night, a little black heart painted on my cheek and this whole ridiculous outfit. It was the 80s, so I had on leg warmers and, you know. And, of course, I was doing like 80 down Peachtree. got pulled over and cop ran my tag and whatever. And also, part of my story is I never drove with a current tag. I never drove with insurance. I never drove with a license. I mean, my license always had some other address. I mean, you know, that's how I lived my life. My life was completely unmanageable, but I didn't think it was. And so he pulls me over and says, well, you know, I'm going to have to arrest you and blah, blah, blah. I was like, what? Because I'd gotten a bench warrant and I'd thrown it in the trash. I didn't know what happened. I didn't care. I was sure it would be fine, just like the tickets were. Yeah, that was not the case. So so I go to downtown Fulton County Jail on a Friday night where there was some huge concert that night at the Omni. I don't know what it was. And so they'd arrested, like, tons of people for smoking dope in the concert and whatever. And so the jailhouse was pretty full. And there I am dressed like a hooker in the little jailhouse. And I don't remember seeing a whole lot of other women there. There might have been, but I don't remember seeing them. I just remember it was freezing in there. The jail was new. It was the new jail in Fulton County. And the computer system wasn't working, so they were not able to process people electronically. So it was taking a very long time to get processed and get to a cell. If this tells you anything about my personality, they took the photo, my mugshot, right? And I thought I looked really cute, and I asked them, could I take the other three? And they said yes. My roommate came and bailed me out, so on and so forth. But when I went, and I only had one phone call, so I couldn't call my job and say, it was a bar. They're not going to answer the phone anyway at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever time it was. So, but the next day, I just walked into work and said, here I am. And the DJ started playing Jailhouse Rock. And I took my little three pictures and I stuck them up on the bulletin board in the employee break room. And somebody wanted Dead or Alive $1.50 reward. And, you know, it became a big joke. You know, it's amazing to me how many times alcoholics have to learn lessons. Okay, I'll just speak for myself, this alcoholic. Because that did not stop me from driving like an idiot and getting moving violations and so on and so forth. I think there was another bench warrant out for my arrest for the same reason, throwing out everything. And they showed up at my door that time and actually took me to jail. They didn't book me, but they took me to jail. I don't even remember the rest of that story. But that's my experience. It takes sometimes, many times, even well into sobriety to learn some lessons. And I think that's why it's called a daily reprieve. Because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous wanting this to all be like, okay, got those steps, check. No, I'm not going to do that one. Yes, I'll do that one. Okay, maybe that one, and I'll talk to somebody else about that. I'm not going to do it here. You know, I mean, I was going to work my program. And I don't know if anybody else has tried that in this room, but that didn't work for me very well. Anyway, like I said, I drove drunk a lot. One night I drove somebody else's car with them in it, in a blackout. It was a guy I worked with at the restaurant. I'd graduated at this point in time to waiting tables in white tablecloth restaurants because I thought I wouldn't drink as much. And that was not the case because those people drank just as much as me. I thought they drank more, of course. But you know, the next morning, the horrible hangover. And I was not a person that ever said, I'm never doing that again. That just wasn't my thing. Oh, the other thing about my story is I was a binge drinker. I was not a daily drinker. I could go a day, a week, sometimes even a month. Not without drinking, but without getting, like, drunk. But something would happen. Some kind of emotional, you know, anger, fear, whatever would hit me, and I'd have to drink because I didn't have any tools to deal with it any other way. And I needed something to change the way I felt, and that was alcohol for me. I'm always amazed when I think back about how I had a resentment against Alcoholics Anonymous, that contempt prior to investigation, before I even got here. Even though my dad lived, you know, a pretty decent sober life, you know, so I had that example. And I think some other friends of his I saw, but it didn't matter. I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to be like him. I wasn't going to drink like him. And I didn't drink like him, so I didn't drink every day. So that meant I wasn't an alcoholic. And what I saw as an alcoholic was the police knocking on our door and bringing him home, you know, where he'd spent all of his money on payday and then gotten beaten up and left in the gutter and the police bringing him home and my mother saying, you deal with him, at like 10 or 11 or 12, you know. And what I would do is take all the cigarettes out of his pack and draw a line on him and tell him, don't smoke past this point, Dad. I was a good little Al-Anon, untreated him. Drove the car with the guy in it, in a blackout. Next morning, horrible hangover. We're sitting in Frankie Allen Park on Piedmont Road, and all of a sudden, I have a speaker CD where the guy talks about that he believes that every alcoholic has a moment of clarity before they get sober. And that was the truth for me. I sat there and I thought, all I could think about was all the yes. All I could think about was all the things that had not happened to me yet that I could see that were out there. DUIs, jail, killing myself, killing somebody else, all of it. I thought, something's not right about this. I think this is not how normal people drink, whatever that means. And so I called my oldest sister, who, what an ironic twist, she is now in a nursing home because she has alcoholic dementia. Never got sober, never wanted to get sober. My family wasn't willing to do an intervention. But I called her for whatever reason. We had never talked about our drinking. And she said, you know, honey, maybe this is the thing that's been holding you back your whole life. And I was like, wow, I never thought I'd been being held back my whole life, but okay. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to a meeting. I picked up my white chip at Bell Kirk on a Friday night over in Decatur. And, you know, everyone was so nice. And I thought that was so weird because I was like, I don't know you people. You know, they want to give me their phone number. Some guy came up to me, bought me a big book. I was like, what do you want from me? But that's how I was. I didn't trust. I was always like, what do you want from me? No, Of course, they gave me phone numbers and told me about meetings and so on and so forth. And somebody told me about a meeting in downtown Clarkston. And so I went the next day. Don't ask me why, but I did. That first meeting at Bell Kirk, I don't know if anybody else can relate to this, but I had equal parts, 50-50. I want to run screaming from the building, and I never want to let go of this chair. It was just the weirdest thing ever. And so... So I went to this meeting in downtown Clarkston. In fact, I got pulled over on the way there for speeding. And when I told the cop, he was like, where are you going in such a hurry? And I was like, well, you wouldn't believe me if I told you, but I'm going to a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous. And he handed me back my license and he said, we'll get there safely. And I was like, well, okay. So I went. It was supposedly in downtown Clarkston. I went to where they told me it was, and there was no meeting going on. There were some people there. And they were, I think, cleaning that place, whatever it was. I guess it was an AA place. But he said, but, you know, there's this meeting at this place called Clarkston over on Lewis Road. And they're having a meeting at 12:30, and you could go there. And I was like, okay. So I went there, and I walked in, and they were having this newcomers panel, which if you haven't ever been to Clarkston at 12:30 on a Sunday, it's a great meeting. There's a panel of, like, three people with, I think, five or more years of sobriety. And there's a topic, and there's an ask it basket, and you can ask questions and stuff. And these people share their experience, strength, and hope on the topic. And I think it's always been a really good meeting. And that was the meeting that was going on. And I was really thrilled because I didn't have to share, and I could just listen to people. And there were some cute guys there, so I thought, well, I can come back here. You know, motives don't count, right, as long as it gets me to the meeting. And so I did go back about once a week, maybe, to a meeting. No, I didn't hear 90 and 90. I didn't hear a lot of things. Or I chose to ignore the things that I heard. That's probably a little more accurate. Because I was going to do my program. I did not get a sponsor. And when I finally did get one, I got one who went to Bell Kirk so I wouldn't have to see her. I didn't understand what that whole sponsorship thing. I came in with no concept of God, didn't want one. That's great for you sheep that need something to follow, because I was so arrogant. And so closed-minded, you know, and they talked about being open-minded, and I was like, I'm open-minded. I was not open-minded. Don't forget, because I came in with that huge resentment against Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in hating my father. Everything was his fault. Everything that ever happened to me was his fault, pretty much. I took no responsibility for any of the decisions I made, even after he got sober. We didn't talk for quite a few years at one point in time, and then my stepmother number two actually asked me to come and surprise him for his 65th birthday. And we hadn't spoken in about 3 years, because I wasn't going to talk to him. She said, I'll pay your ticket, you can come, whatever, and blah, blah, blah. And so my sister that lived up there and her husband and the kids picked me up and stowed me away at their house. We went to the party the next day. They stowed me away in the garage. He was coming out to greet people. And he came out as somebody else was coming up, and they told me, go, go, go. And I went out, and he burst into tears. Burst into tears, and ran over to me, picked me up, swung me around. I mean, I think he was just shocked beyond belief that I had actually shown up for something for him. Because he knew how I felt about him. I made no bones about that. You know, Elizabeth's program didn't work very well. I spent about 9 months doing that. Go to a meeting once a week, maybe, not really using a sponsor. And the sponsor I got talked more about her than we ever talked about me. So that was great for me. Because I didn't have to talk about me. We never talked about working any steps, at least not that I remember. I didn't work any steps. I didn't pray. I wasn't willing to believe in any kind of God. It was definitely, you know, my program. And at about 9 months, dry, basically, all the crap that I had accumulated in my life that I had not dealt with came flying forward, and I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I was waking up crying, going to bed crying, and a friend of mine said, you know, I'm concerned about you, and called a crisis therapist. I started to see a therapist, and they suggested either medication or hospitalization, and I said, well, I don't even like any of those options. What else do you have? And he said, really not much. That's pretty much about it. So I talked to my sponsor. I got on medication. You know, what I thought I would get out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really believe there is no lie to that expression if I'd made a list of what I thought I wanted. Because I don't even know what that would have been, because I had no idea what I wanted my whole life, certainly not even after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I will tell you is that I had 5 years sober, both my dad and I sober together. And that was nothing short of a miracle. Coming in and hating him and hating myself and never thinking anything in my life was ever going to change. And so many things in my life have changed. And again, not the things that I thought necessarily were going to change. But I'm really grateful that I do believe in a higher power today that does have my best interest at heart and has a plan for my life. I don't always like it. I want you to come down, explain it to me, map it out for me. Then, you know, and if you want me to do anything, I need to understand how it works. And I've, no, it doesn't work that way. Not been my experience anyway. I have to be willing to do it. This guy said this great thing in a meeting a couple weeks ago. I have to continue to do the things that I don't believe are going to work and continue to see the results. I was like, wow. I think he had like 2 months sober. I was like, wow, amazing. And that's been my experience. I have to do the things that I don't think are going to work. I don't have to like it. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to want to do it. But if I want the results, I have to do it. And, you know, you and I, were you and I talking about being defiant right before the, yeah. You know, sometimes I can still dig my heels in and be defiant about stuff. And sometimes I forget to include God in things in my life. I've been going through a really hard time at my job, which is a quality problem, because I have a great job, and they gave me more stuff to do. Not really more money, but anyway. I couldn't hold a job to save my life when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could get them, but I could never keep them, because I couldn't show up. Alcoholics Anonymous was the first thing that I ever really learned how to show up on a regular basis, and it took time for me to even be able to do that, or willing to do that. When I was about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years sober, I think, my sponsor at the time, Sharon, I don't know what we were talking about. She's awesome. She said, whatever we were talking about, she looked at me and she goes, you're like the most defiant person I've ever met in my life. And she had like, I don't know, 30 years sober at the time. And I thought that was an awesome thing. Like, I was like, yes, that's awesome. You know what? Today, though, fast forward however many years since then, I don't want to be that person anymore. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I want to be that person. You know, I mean, I'm human. My instincts get threatened, just like everybody else's. But I don't really want to be that person anymore, because I know the results that come from that. And it's not the results that I want in my life. And thinking that I know what's best for me, not really a good plan. I was doing some step work. I went to, you know, that high school that I went to, I only got to go for three years. I won't go into the story about why, but anyway, I left, and I was very ashamed that I couldn't go back and finish that experience with those girls, because they became my family, and their families became my family. So I would never go to a reunion because I was embarrassed, and so on and so forth, and my sponsor at the time said, I think you should go to your, whatever it was, 15th something, and I didn't want to go, but I did it anyway. And it was one of the most amazing gifts I could have ever given myself. because those girls were just like welcoming and loving, and all the people that were the cool kids that I liked when I was in high school were not the people I was interested in anymore. It was the people that I thought were the dorks and the, you know, smart people and the people that I never hung out with. Those were the ones that I was like super attracted to, and I was like, huh, this is an interesting twist. And when I went back for the second one, which was 10 years later, at the cocktail party, and I did not keep in touch with any of those people. They tried to stay in touch with me. Went back to, and on Saturday night, the cocktail party at somebody's house, they're all getting a little loose-lipped because they've had a little bit to drink, and or a lot to drink. And slowly but surely, they all started walking up to me with tears in their eyes, saying, we never knew what happened to you. We never knew why you didn't come back. And you could have knocked me over with a feather. Because I never thought that they cared. I mean, I just, you know, I cut them off. I figured they'd kind of done the same thing to me, even though some of them had tried, a number of them had tried to reach out to me on a regular basis. So, you know, it's again the I don't know the good news from the bad news. I don't know what's best for me, so on and so forth. God continues to show me that, and I don't think it matters how long we've been here. And I'm grateful for that today. I was not grateful for that many times, but I am today. When I got back from that trip, my sponsor and I were working through the steps. Again, I was having a little struggle with 2 and 3. I don't know about this God thing. For whatever reason at that point in my sobriety. And so we were going back through the steps. And so step 2, she wanted me to write a list of the things that, of what I thought God was. And I was like, what? And then she wanted me to write a list of what I would like my God to be, which I thought was, for someone who didn't believe in God, it's ridiculous to even say this. I thought that was blasphemous. There is God. You have to believe in the God, whatever that is, and that's all you get. You can't just make up your own. And even though it says here, wherever it is, you know, God's your understanding. And so I that list, and then a list of the things, this was the killer, list of things that had happened in my life that had nothing to do with me. Like the good things that had happened in my life that I had nothing to do with, which I'm sure she did. You know, she probably had a big smile on her face when she said that one to me because she knew I was going to see what she wanted me to see, which was that, you know, God had always been working in my life, whether I believed in him or not, him, her, it, whatever you want to call it, higher power. And so I wrote the list of the things that, evidence of God working in my life that I had nothing to do with. And I brought it to her, and we did that. We did those three lists, and we talked about that stuff. And she said, don't shoot the messenger here. And I said, okay. She said, did it ever occur to you that if your mother hadn't died when she did and your dad hadn't married that woman, you would not have been sent to that boarding school. You would not have met those women. You would not have made those relationships. You would not have just had that experience. I was like, now that is some serious, I'm not sure what, for you to connect those dots, you know, but I know that everything I've gone through, drinking and sober, is so that I can help somebody else, everything. I never in a million years thought that having my mother die at 13, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, would be so that I could help somebody else. But everything that I go through is so that I can help somebody else, and, you know, I'd love to tell you that I love, you know, when I'm going through a hard time, I can be like, yay, I'm going to be able to help somebody else. No, not always the case. And so I'm really, really grateful for sponsorship because it isn't, for me, it's not been just about working the steps. It's been about helping me learn how to be a sober woman in recovery and how to live life as an adult because I did not know how to live life as an adult. I owed the IRS because the rules didn't apply to me, right? I just, you know, I threw out crap that came from the IRS in the mail, too. And I made amends for that stuff. Took a long time because I, you know, I was a waitress. I didn't make any money. They weren't going to get any money from me. So many of the things that I came in with such contempt prior to investigation about with Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm just incredibly grateful that I didn't get what I asked for and that I got the result of doing the work. And that doesn't matter how long I've been here, and that never changes. If I'm willing to do the work, the results come. Now, the trick is, they may not be what I think they should be, or what I want them to be, but they have always been what I've needed. Whether I like to admit the truth about that or not, they have been. You know, like I said, my dad and I had 5 years together in sobriety, which was awesome. My life is awesome. It's not perfect, but it's awesome. One of the things I always want to do my whole life before I got sober and after I got sober and was too scared to do was sing. Since I was, I don't even know, I couldn't even tell you how old. And I was always too afraid, so I would never do anything about it. When I was drinking, I was even too afraid to go, like, get drunk and do karaoke. I would get drunk and come home and, you know, belt it out in my bedroom, waking up my roommates at 3 o'clock in the morning. I got sober, and I was still too afraid to do something about it. And so they used to perform here. I don't know if anybody remembers the Coffee House Entertainers. I was in that for about 3 years, and that was God. I had nothing to do with that. Melissa was supposed to be in it. She had to back out. They told her, who do you know that can do this? And she said, you know, Elizabeth's got a great voice. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I went intentionally to try to fail the audition. That didn't work. And then God put a man in my life who was a musician and said, heard me sing. And he's like, why are you not singing? And I was like, because I'm not going to, man. And he was like, we're starting a band. And I was like, okay. So we started a band. And then that relationship ended. So the band ended. And now I sing in this other band who has performed here at the Coffee House a couple times. And it's just one of the greatest joys of my life. I just absolutely love it. I was singing my heart out on the way here in the car. And I was thinking about this new song that the band is going to learn. We do Americana. It's a country kind of thing. But it's called My House. And I think if I can remember the last line of the song, I'm not going to be able to remember it. But it basically reminded me of Alcoholics Anonymous, how we're not in this alone, how we do it all together. And, you know, and that's, sometimes my alcoholism still wants me to do things alone, but you guys don't let me. And I'm really, really grateful to have a network of people that surround me, whether I want them to or not. And more often than not, I do today because I want the results that come from that. So that's about it for me. Thank you for letting me share.
On that broad highway. brothers on that broad highway.